Coming up, we're talking Celtics, AD, MPJ, Suns, Warriors, NBA draft, and a whole lot else that's coming up right now. All right, let's talk some NBA. Joining me, my old friend, Big Waz, host of No Files Given. Waz, how are you, man?
I'm fantastic. Happy to be back on with you, bro.
I appreciate you coming on today, man. Since you do have Paul Pierce as a co-host on No Files Given, we might as well start with the Boston Celtics because right now, Jaylen Brown is on one for the Celtics right now. Over the last week, he expressed disbelief that Jalen Brunson was named player of the month. And then he streamed on Twitch. He danced salsa with Victoria Monet. And he proclaimed himself the best two-way player in the game. And then with Victoria Monet sitting courtside in Los Angeles, he dropped 50 points on the Clippers while locking down Kawhi Leonard. This season, was he's averaging 30.1 points, 60.2% true shooting. Those are career highs. 5 assists per game, also a career high. Jaylen Brown, what a run he's on, Waz.
I think he's earned the right to pound his chest at this point. There's just no two ways about it. And I was saying in the offseason that I was disappointed in the way that Boston conducted their offseason. It felt like shedding salary was the number one goal. And it felt like they were treating this season as a lost season, where I was like, man, I don't know, Jaylen Brown and the guys from last year's team could still be a pretty compelling product.
Jaylen Brown pretty good. They traded some of their key guys.
Dude, that's what I'm saying. Like, they got rid of so many people. I'm like, wouldn't you want to bring these guys back and have a competent team? It felt like they were treating it like, all right, this isn't going to be competitive next year. That's what it felt like to me. All of the moves, all of the salary being shed. And I was wondering, too, I was like, would they have done this if Jaylen Brown was the guy that went down and Tatum would be back? I feel like they'd be treating it as like, no, we still have our guy here. We can still be competitive. So it felt like Boston was throwing in the towel on the season during the offseason. And the reports were the priority is to get rid of money. And, you know, I'll be damned if I wasn't wrong and Brad Stevens wasn't absolutely right in the way he conducted the offseason. And the truth of the matter is Jaylen Brown is playing like a superstar. There's no qualifications here. Like this guy is playing like one of the best players in the NBA. He's getting it done on both ends of the court. He's improved in basically every single facet of his offensive game. He's getting to the line more. He's making his mid-rangers at a higher clip. He's making his threes. He's distributing the ball. Like, he's doing everything better on offense, and he's always been a high quality defender, and so he's lifted Boston in a way that I just couldn't have foreseen. I don't know about you, KLC.
No, I could not have seen this coming. I mean, I don't think maybe only Joe Mazzulla could have seen this coming. Yeah. As crazy as he is for the Celtics to be at this level so far this year, but ultimately Jaylen Brown, I think if there's anybody else that could have seen this coming, it would be him, because Jaylen Brown, he's made a career of proving people wrong. I mean, I was there on draft night when the Celtics took him, and there was some fans booing in the arena that night and wishing, oh, you know, we should have taken Dunn out of Providence. We should have traded for Jimmy Butler. And Jaylen Brown goes on to have the career that he's had. And even during his career, break up Tatum and Brown. No, they play through it and they grow through it. They go on to win a championship. Tatum tears his Achilles and, well, the Celtics are going to suck this year. Let's, you know, go draft the top prospect. And, well, no, Jaylen Brown is one of the top five candidates for MVP. I mean, at this point in
time,
because some of the guys that are going to be out due to injury and all that, not meeting the 65 game threshold. But Waz, ultimately, with Jaylen, one of the reasons why he's experienced this improvement so far this year is because of his pick and roll scoring development. With Jaylen Brown this year, if you look at his numbers, he's scoring 1.07 points per pick and roll. That's a career high for him by far. Just last year, it was 0.83 points per pick and roll. The year before that, it was 0.91. His career high previously was 0.96 points per pick and roll as a scorer in the pick and roll. So with Jalen, it's career high for him. And it's not just the numbers. You know, it's not just career highs per game. It's just watching the games. This is a player who looks so much more comfortable at every level out of the pick and roll. If you go under on a screen against him, he's pulling up from three against you. If you don't go under, if you're going to switch that screen or play at the level, he can drive into you and finish through contact with either hand at the rim. If you switch it, he's very comfortable isolating against smaller guys, bigger guys, using either strength or power to get into the paint. He's scoring in literally every single way, using mid-range jumpers at the most efficient level of his career. He looks like a complete basketball player right now for the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, you just got to watch the games to notice that his imprint is on everything. And I think in the past, it's kind of felt like, I don't even want to say the knock, but like what people go to in saying that Tatum is a much better player, an obviously better player, is that Tatum would often draw the defense's top defender, right? Like they would send their best guys to guard Tatum one-on-one. The game plan would be geared around Tatum. And, you know, at times Brown would just be operating around the fringes. Whereas this year, there is no such, there's no caveats. The defenses are throwing everything that they have at him, and he's just responding. And I would actually disagree with you, KOC, about him partly being in the MVP conversation right now because guys went down. I think if Wemby, Jokic, still had the requisite amount of games for MVP consideration, I think Jaylen Brown would still be on that ballot and deservedly so, and is showing himself to be knocking on the door of that type of player. I think Shea and Jokic are in a class of their own, honestly. But the idea that Jaylen Brown isn't knocking right there on that door, even like a Luka Doncic, who, you know, the production and the numbers, the raw numbers are always eye-popping. But again, we see what this guy does on defense. We see how his effort level can wax and wane. I don't think he's setting a tone in terms of competitive spirit and drive and forcefulness for the Lakers in the way that Jaylen Brown is doing. I would say this guy is right there, even without the injury situations that we've seen around the league.
I think that's incredibly fair. I mean, I think with him, to your point about Luka, the Lakers have won a couple games in a row now. Vibes are a little bit better after vibes were down for a little while with the Lakers. But ultimately, Jokic might not hit that 65 games. SGA is a turned ankle away from suddenly this being one of the craziest, you know, MVP discussions down the stretch of the year. And I think with Jaylen Brown, there is a real argument for him over some of these other guys. I mean, he's 36-5 with great defense. That is not something you can say, the last part, about Luka. And I think with like Jaylen Brown is the key reason why Boston has been as great as they've been so far this season. And on Pauly market, he only has a 2% odds right now at winning NBA MVP. I think that feels a little bit low to me. I think so, too. If you are a better, whether it's, you know, you Pauly market, prediction markets, or like a BetMGM or whatever, the odds aren't bad for Jaylen right now. And the Celtics at 22-12 right now, was they're the 3 seed, 3.5 games back from the Pistons for the 1 seed. They have a plus 7 point net rating, third best in the NBA behind OKC and Houston. That's crazy. That's wild. Yeah. That they're this good at this point of the season in early January. I mean, Joe Mazzulla, I think there's a real shot that this guy actually is like the best coach in the league. Talk about, you know, awards, coach of the year for Joe Mazzulla. Strong argument there with him doing this year with this Celtics roster.
Yeah, Mazzulla, again, we talk about culture in different places, and I was skeptical of the offseason because I just felt like, why would as a championship level team, why would you make your team purposely worse? I just don't like the message that it sends culturally that, oh, this season isn't going to be as meaningful as before. our MVP candidate, our best player is down. We know we can't be expected to be at our very best at the level that we made our fans accustomed to. So we're not going to treat the season this kind of way. And I don't know. I hated that as an idea, but the reason why I was wrong is that Joe Mazzulla doesn't believe in that. Joe Mazzulla is a competitive maniac. Like, he's not going to stand for an idea that you would punt on a season. Every opportunity that you get to play NBA basketball is an opportunity to compete at the highest level, and they're going to meet that challenge collectively. And Joe Mazzulla has to be part of that identity as the head man in charge. And then, you know, you talk about the leaders and the best players in terms of Jaylen Brown and Derek White. I tip my cap to them, because even Indy, who I think those guys tried, like, especially early on in the season, they were just losing a bunch of close games, which, you know, have a lot of random variants, but they were in a similar mode in the sense that their best player tore his Achilles. They got rid of some guys, but there's still some a lot of the core that went to the NBA Finals, went to Game 7 with, you know, God's favorite team, apparently, the OKC Thunder. And I just assumed...
God's favorite team. They're only on pace for 68 wins now.
Whatever. Don't get me started on the media's obsession with OKC and their alleged infallibility and invincibility, and Sam Presti is the most genius. Don't get me started. But to contrast the Pacers and the Celtics, I thought they had very similar off seasons. You know, where it's just like, look, our best player went down. We're gonna shed some money. We're going to treat this as a whatever type of season. But I thought Indy would be more competitive and Boston would be less so. But, you know, the fortunes have just been completely reversed. And I think it's because Jaylen Brown has made himself into an MVP candidate. There's no MVP candidates on Indy this year, much as we love Pascal Siakam.
Finals MVP Jaylen Brown, and who knows, maybe future NBA MVP Jaylen Brown as well. We'll see about that. You mentioned the Thunder. The Suns had an 18-point comeback against the Phoenix Suns on Sunday night. The Suns are now 21-14 this season. I thought in this game against the Thunder it was an amazing defensive performance by Phoenix. The work they did against SGA held him to only 8 of 22, only 9 free throws, throwing two bodies at him through a lot of the game on his drives to the basket, forcing the ball out of his hands, putting him into tough shots as well, playing very aggressively defensively as well. Really good whistle. I thought, like, in this game, the referees did a good job calling it very evenly on both sides, made things hard on him, whether it was Royce O'Neal as a guy on ball, or even Goodwin, Devin Booker some of the time. It was different guys, and Ryan Dunn, it was like that all night in the game, forcing him into tough shots, forcing him into some turnovers. And ultimately, the Suns team, they continue to just be gritty, tough, fun to watch. And this was really, I thought, one of their best wins. It was their best win of the season against the OKC Thunder.
I gotta say, man, I think Dylan Brooks deserves a lot of credit for the turnaround that we've seen in Phoenix. And the truth of the matter is, this is the third team in a row that he's changed the sort of complexion and identity of what they do since he got there. He did it in Memphis, who's been wayward. They have been adrift. They've been lost at sea. I could come up with a million metaphors for what Memphis has been since Dylan Brooks is gone. Like, they've been a mess in terms of their identity, in terms of their consistency, especially on the defensive end, since Dylan Brooks is gone. Mind you, they got a perennial alleged defensive player of the year in Jaren Jackson on their team, their roster, that still remains, and that hasn't, you know, held up consistently. Houston, the same thing. I know that they got rid of him to bring KD into the building, which obviously is a no-brainer, the kind of thing you have to do, specifically when your offense was as bad as it was in the playoffs last year. But Dylan Brooks changed those guys and how they played as well, and now he's doing it in Phoenix. And he's adding an offensive punch, which you couldn't really claim that he was doing in previous stops. And so I think Dylan Brooks deserves a lot of credit. I think Jordan Ott deserves a lot of credit. I think Devin Booker, who, again, he spent 2 years to me in a bit of an offensive leadership wilderness since CP3 left the team. It just didn't feel like Devin Booker was as impactful as he was the previous 2 years before the last 2 years when he's going to NBA Finals and Phoenix is winning 60 games, etc. And so I think those three guys deserve a lion's share of the credit. And then the role players are, you know, they're buying in. These guys play hard every single night. I know that it's cliche to say this, but a lot of defense is effort and, you know, executing on your assignment and actually being in your spots and giving it some level of the offense, some level of resistance. And it sounds trite and all of that, but, you know, we watch teams like the Lakers play every single day and they can't do it on a night to night basis. So Phoenix being able to have this level of consistent defensive output every single game is incredible. And again, another team that nobody had any expectations for coming into the season. It was almost like, what can Phoenix even do to improve their lot? Like, they seem to be stuck and mired in, you know, constant mediocrity. And it turns out, you know, getting Dylan Brooks and having a coach instill a defensive blue-collar mindset to your approach to basketball and how you're going to win on a night-to-night basis, that works and it helps.
I mean, it absolutely works. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head with Dylan Brooks and his influence. I mean, another guy I've been critical of, especially at the end of Memphis, I said I wouldn't even want him on a minimum contract, how bad of a take that was at the time. But, like, things ended so poorly. I mean, the Grizzlies general manager, Zach Kleiman, had a press conference about we're not going to bring that guy back. I mean, that's how bad it was at the end of the time in Memphis. But he did change the Grizzlies. He did change the Rockets. And he is changing the Phoenix Suns, and it's not just with his defensive ability, as you said. I mean, the step-back jumper, the three-pointer he hit in the final minute, I mean, that's crazy. With SGA
followed
right
it up
face.
With an insane turnover, but that shot, I was, you know, I text a couple of buddies, like what am I living in the upside down? Dylan Brooks is a crunch time go-to performer? Did he take, like... A hard
He's
dribble,
living the dream
step
was.
To his left. It's bro, it's insane. And, you know, people point to the antics with the LeBron stuff and all of that. Like, you got to understand, even when he's doing this stuff, this guy brings a level of intensity to every single game. He's there's no nights off with this guy. And in a team environment, guys feed off of that stuff, Kev. Like, it's contagious when you have a guy who there's no shortcuts. He does everything at maximum intensity. And you see he's not backing down from guys like Luka Doncic and LeBron James. You know, I got a lot of respect for what Dylan Brooks has made himself into, man. Obviously, the defense and the intensity has been there since the Memphis days. But what he's done, his work that he's put into the offseason to make himself into a credible offensive player, which is just something I just didn't think would ever be in the cards for this kid. And that he's doing this consistently in Phoenix is quite incredible. You don't you have to be maniacal about the way that you work in order to make these levels of improvements, KOC.
At the bottom of the screen, if you're watching the show on YouTube, it says kind of tongue in cheek, OKC now on pace for only 68 games.
Can we talk about the OKC thing?
Yeah, let's talk about them.
It's this whole fucking guys in our industry, the things that they love the most are transactions, are managerial minutia. So they love to laud what Presti does from his office. It's what they love to praise damn near more than anything. And it's like, look at the draft picks he's amassed. Look at this. Look at that. Whoa. It's like, guys, Presti is definitely, if not the best, he's in the top two or three management guys in the NBA. There's no two ways about it.
All of sports.
Let's give him that. Bottom line is they traded for a guy that nobody knew was an MVP candidate, including Sam Presti. Okay? That's why they're at where they're at. Yes, they put themselves in position to win and all of that. They traded for Shea. It was luck. The Clippers didn't know he was a future MVP. Sam Presti didn't know he was a future MVP. Nobody knew this guy was a future MVP. Not a single person. And we love J-Dub. We love Chet. I love Chet especially. That's not why these guys are who they are. They got a MVP. They got an all-time great player in a trade that nobody thought that that's what they were getting in return. Okay, leave that to the side. Just this idea that OKC, because they have draft picks, because they have young guys on cheap deals, that they will now win in perpetuity, that they are now this invincible force, that they are this flawless team. It's like, guys, these guys are beatable. Like, this isn't the KD, the KD-led Golden State Warriors, where it was just like, you know what? This is an inevitable force. Outside of Klay Thompson and KD have suffering season-ending injuries, nobody has a chance against these guys. That's not what OKC is, y'all. I'm sorry. And I don't feel like I'm saying something controversial, but in our industry, this narrative that grew around OKC about 10 years of dominance and will they ever lose a championship? And it's like, y'all, they should have lost fucking Indy. Nobody's idea of an all-time great world-beating team. Just in June, we watched this happen. And so in the last few weeks, OKC has sort of come down to earth. I think they're the favorite to win the championship. Just like I thought Denver was the favorite to win the championship in 23. That doesn't mean you're inevitable. That doesn't mean you're invincible. That doesn't mean that this OKC thing is this otherworldly. Oh, my God, I can't believe a GM is this. It's like, yeah, just please relax. These guys can be beat. It's going to be proven time and time again. If you give me OKC or the field, I'm taking the field in the playoffs this year. Like, it's just the chatter around it. Of course, it's changed now because of what San Antonio did to them in the span of 10 days. But the chatter was always ridiculous, Kev.
To your point, Waz, you've been pretty consistent with this. First of all, I'll back up. I don't think they are unbeatable. I think that has definitely been made clear over the past month. Denver went to 7 against them. Indiana went to 7 against them. And even if they are better this season, we did see against San Antonio turning them into a three-point shooting team. I've talked about that on the pod a bunch. I talked about it in Vegas with Amin Al-Hassan after that first loss. Talked about it on other podcasts. If you can turn them into a shooting team and keep them out of the paint, which is what they want to do, and like what Denver did with their zone defense last year, you can impact them. I think the Suns' defense, if a series is officiated in this manner for both teams, mm-hmm. I think playing aggressively on defense like OKC does, if you play like them on defense, they are not going to blow the whistle on you every single play. I think there's something to learn there rather than to complain about with the way OKC is officiated when they're on defense. Learn from that rather than complain about it, in my opinion. Now, to your point, Waz, you've been pretty consistent with this. I know on your podcast, No Fouls Given, you said recently, I think it was either the last episode or the one before that, that you don't think the Thunder should be complacent, that you'd be looking for trades there. What would you be looking at if you're Presti? If you're advising Sam Presti, one of the top three talent evaluators, GMs in sports, what are you telling Sam Presti to look for with this Thunder roster?
Go blow Memphis away with a draft pick package. Excuse me, not Memphis, sorry. Go blow New Orleans away with a draft pick package for Trey Murphy. What's the point of having all these freaking draft picks if you're not going to make your team way better immediately? Like, this idea that the future is so bright and we're going to be so good. It's like, bro, ACLs are snapping all the time. Achilles are snapping all the time. Dudes are getting high ankle sprains, or just in their series against the Nuggets where my guy Aaron Gordon hurts his hamstring and is basically incapacitated for game 7. These things happen all the time. The idea that you wouldn't reify your roster with the riches that you've accumulated in the now, that you don't need more shooting, I find it to be foolish. I think when they stood pat at the trade deadline 2 years ago, when they were like, no, we're just good with just having Chet Holmgren and Jalen Williams as our two bigs and our only bigs, and they got mauled on the glass. They got mauled on the interior by Dallas, by that very weakness that everybody predicted. Then in the offseason, they get Hartenstein and improves and all of that. But, like, I think this is the same thing. Your shooting is bad. You have bad shooters. Like, and it's not – excuse me. I shouldn't say bad. You don't have panic-level shooters. You yeah, don't have shooters like that put the defense in a panic.
These guys that make you sweat. Right? Like these guys that you're worried about constantly. I remember, I always think about this quote every time the subject comes up, like 10 years ago at a little pregame scrum with Brad Stevens. He said, Kyle Korver averages 15 points per game. You have to defend him like he scores 35. And that's what you're saying that OKC doesn't have on their roster. And that's the type of guy that you want them to go seek out and get. That's what you're saying.
And people would be like, well, Isaiah Joe and Wiggins and Kayson Wallace, they made shots. It's like, bro. The defense is not bending to the will of Kayson Wallace. The defense isn't bending to the will of Wiggins. How look, Isaiah Joe shoots the lights out of the ball. We've seen count how many playoffs in a row are we going to watch them yank him from the lineup because he's so small and easily attacked. You're not going to have that issue with Trey Murphy. I just think that you should be trying to take risks, you know, in terms of building the roster for this year. Because, again, you're not infallible. And yo, I'm not saying you shouldn't feel like you shouldn't feel confident in a series against Denver or Houston or Phoenix or whoever the hell you play, the Lakers, you name it. I'm not saying you shouldn't feel confident that you could win. But the bottom line is if Denver had the ability to make their roster appreciably better, they'd be doing it. You know, if the Knicks had the opportunity, Detroit does, and I bet you they're weighing those options right now. But you know what I mean?
Like, there are teams that have kind of Harris for Detroit, someone like
yes,
that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. There are teams that have, you know, kind of maxed out without doing something extremely dramatic on making the team better. OKC is nowhere close to that limit. This notion that they should just stand pat because their team is perfect is ridiculous to me.
I think what you're touching on was, I mean, these teams, there's an opportunity this year to go for it, to make a run. There's no juggernaut Warriors inevitable that they're in the finals. I think especially in the Eastern Conference, teams should go for it. Like we just talked about the Celtics.
Oh my God.
They should try to add another big. Like Cade has been really good, but they should try to find another big as well. The Pistons should try to find an upgrade over Tobias Harris. They should try to turn Jaden Ivey into something that increases your odds because it's open. And you get into a finals, even if you're not the favorite, and Indiana wasn't against the Thunder, you could find yourself in a game 7 and you never know what happened. So it's heartbreaking for the Pacers with what happened with the way they lost that game, Halliburton tearing his Achilles. But in an alternate universe, they win that game and they're the champions. And so I think for all these teams in the West as well, I think it's true for the Warriors. Build around Stephen Curry. Like, try to increase your odds. The Spurs, there's no guarantee that at age 27, Victor Wembanyama, he might be a cautionary tale at that point. It's just it's a possibility. Or he'll be in the prime of his career. But if he is in the prime of his career at age 27, you won't regret going for it now and trying to take advantage of this opportunity that's in front of you with a really good Spurs team. So I think there's so many teams around the league that should be going for it right now.
We'll be right back.
And I think, you know, one of the guys that gets mentioned a lot in trade discussions is Michael Porter Jr. The year he's having for the Brooklyn Nets, we saw him face Denver, his old team, the other night. He had 27 points on, I think it was Sunday, that game. MPJ is having an awesome season. A guy like him, I can think of like 10 teams that should be making offers to the Nets to go get MPJ with the level that he's always performed at in Denver, but also the things he's showing on a higher volume, the ball in his hands more often now with the Brooklyn Nets. I'm almost not even sure I want to trade him if I'm the Nets. That's how good he's been. But I definitely want to go for him if I'm like 10 plus teams in the league.
Yeah, I think OKC's not a fit temperamentally. Sam Presti seems to be more attracted to squares, you know, guys that guys that aren't interesting in any way, shape, or form. That tends to be
What you saying about shit. Trey Murphy was? What are you saying about Trey Murphy?
I love Trey Murphy, but he's probably not going to interview a porno chick on his podcast. Like, let's just be real. Like, that's probably not going to happen. So I think just in terms of character makeup, Trey Murphy's a better fit. But I think, yeah, a team like Detroit should absolutely be dying to get their hands on a Porter Jr. I would say Houston should be trying to get their hands on a Porter Jr. because I do think they still lack a certain level of shooting. Mm-hmm. As much as I love what Houston has, I would just say anybody who needs shooting and would want that shooting to have some size should be looking into acquiring Porter Jr. I wonder what the price is now. Also, Porter Jr. has 1 year left after this one, I think, on his deal. He's going to be looking for an extension. He still has the back history, although he's been durable and played. Like, much as we talk about his medical, man, this guy has played a lot of games. You know, like, this guy doesn't miss games, or he hasn't. And so, yeah, I would say that Porter Jr. should be on every contender who's in a bind for shooting. They should be looking at him.
Yeah, I'm with you there, man. I think the third of the league should be trying to get Michael Porter Jr. at this point. And I mean, for the Denver side of things, they lose that game against the Nets. MPJ had 27, as I said. Aaron Gordon came back. Christian Brown returned for Denver, who are still without both their bigs, Nikola Jokic and Jonas Valanciunas. I think it made sense for them to do that trade. I do think it made sense. Oh, Cam Johnson's a very good player, even though he hasn't. Yeah, and they got other guys too. It wasn't just bringing Cam Johnson. They bring back a Bruce Brown. They signed a Tim Hardaway. It opened up more opportunity for Aaron Gordon, who looked like an all-star earlier this year prior to his injury as well. I think there was a lot of reason to do that beyond getting Cam Johnson. But with Denver right now, they're in an interesting spot, Waz. They are two games back from the Spurs for the 2 seed, but they're only 2 games up from the Suns for the 7 seed. So they're smack in the middle right now in the Western Conference without Jokic, without Valanciunas for this next little while. How much are you worried about Denver if they do fall into the play-in here, considering how stacked the top of the Western Conference is? Or does it not really matter to you at all, considering what they are?
I think so. I think a month without Jokic is going to be tough, or 6 weeks, or whatever it may be, 7 weeks. But by the time he comes back, they'll be able to play at a level, at a 700 basketball level, if they so choose, especially when you consider the back half of the schedule where everybody sort of gets locked into the tank. I think they'll be fine in terms of seeding. You want to finish probably like top 6 and just let the chips fall where they may after that. They just want to stay within that 6 range, you know, and I think they'll be able to probably do that. And when Jokic comes back, you know, avoid catastrophe of being in some like crazy playing situation. But I don't think Denver is in that crazy of trouble. It sucks that both of their bigs are gone. Like, not having Jonas is terrible. But I think they're going to find a way to scrounge out wins against bad teams, even in the absence of Jokic. And seeding-wise, you know, you probably want to avoid OKC and probably San Antonio. You want to try to avoid that. But if they end up with the 6th seed, I think they will, and they'll be fine.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think it could even end up a blessing in disguise to be without those guys for a little while, because get to see what some of these dudes with more on their plate, get to see what some of the young guys can do, whether it's Holmes or Pickett, among others on the team. I look forward to seeing the way Denver performs. I mean, the Sixers and Nuggets do play tonight on Monday. I really wish we were getting Jokic versus Embiid, even though Embiid is a bit of a shell of his former self right now. Only just got his first dunk. He had the big celebration. It wasn't even a good dunk, but the big celebration afterwards. But Philly, I'm still so intrigued by Philly because then Embiid has these nights where he looks more like himself against the Knicks on Saturday at 26. He looked more like Joel Embiid. Tyrese Maxey, 36 points. VJ Edgecombe, 26 points. We're talking about how open the league is for the championship window here. And like, Embiid is not Embiid, but sometimes he is. And Tyrese Maxey looks like an all-NBA guy. And VJ Edgecombe looks like a really good player, period, already, besides him being a rookie. You don't need that as a qualifier. He is already a good player. I'm intrigued by Philly, man. I think this is a team also that needs to think about trying to make some moves this year. Waz, I mean, they got a lot of picks they're sitting on. They got Clippers first in 28, a swap in 29. They have first in 2030 and 2032 they can trade on top of their own swaps. They got some flexibility. I'd think about making a move if I'm Philadelphia, even though it's shaky with Embiid right now.
Yeah, I don't know. You have these two insanely big contracts with Paul George and Embiid on there. Any move that doesn't involve moving on from one or both of those picks, like, I wonder what can you even do? Maxey's paid already. Like, what can you even do to put around those guys in a trade that doesn't involve them? To me, if they could get somebody with like salary for Paul George and just making it like, look, we're maximizing you guys on the other end with some beautiful plum picks that we have, I'd be into that. But outside of that, I just don't know. I don't see it. Like, if they could somehow attach Joel Embiid's insane salary with those draft picks in order to upgrade the position with somebody that's going to actually play and be incredible, you know, you wonder, you know. I think somebody like Anthony Davis, right? If you could somehow attach some great picks with Embiid to get AD, but then you're in the same situation. AD doesn't play. Right. Obviously, it's not quite as insane. It's not quite as insane as Embiid, but this guy's just constantly missing games. And, you know, I on the offseason.
There's no way you'd give up Embiid for AD. Would you?
Why?
No way. Embiid's better. Even Embiid in this current state, I'd rather take the upside of Embiid over AD.
No, he's not. He's a horrible defensive player.
He's falling off.
He's a horrible defensive player generating offense.
But the idea of what Embiid can be.
Kev, did you not read the ESPN? Did you not read the ESPN story in the offseason about Joel Embiid? His knees are cooked.
I know.
He's resigned himself to I'm playing out the string. I'm taking my money and calling it a career. It's done. He said it in the article. There's no fixes. There's no cure coming. There's no miracle. Maybe AI could come up with a miracle because AI apparently is going to solve all of our issues. KLC, maybe AI could come up with a miracle that fixes Embiid's knees. But it's over with Embiid. This is not going. There's no corner that's going to turn, right? This is who he is now. He's not going to become more laterally quicker or get off his feet faster or be like, he used to be a defensive monster in the paint. That's done. It's not happening. And so I want to say, I was definitely wrong when I went on Bill's show and said Philly had the most hopeless future in the league because they had two of the worst contracts possible. And I was wrong because Tyrese Maxey is just straight up. He's like, I'm not done getting better. I'm a bona fide all-star, but now I'm just knocking on the door of superstardom. And I'm one of the best players. I'm one of the best scorers in the league. No qualifier, just straight up. I'm one of the best bucket getters in the league. And then, you know, I couldn't have foreseen that a rookie in VJ Edgecombe would just come in and automatically be like a winning kind of player. A disciplined rookie, a guy that plays with poise and understands how to manipulate defenses and doesn't rush himself and doesn't make a bunch of bad plays, has good shot selection instinct. I didn't know a rookie could do that. I was wrong. Okay. I was wrong about those two facts. But the truth of the matter is the Embiid part of it is no, bro. That's done. K. KOC. That like, what are you hoping on if you think Embiid is going to somehow?
You compare against the game against the Bulls about like a week and a half ago. He looked horrific on defense. They went at him play after play after play. Yeah. As soon as he checked in the fourth quarter, he looked better against the Knicks. I think there's going to be nights where it looks horrible, and there's going to be nights where it looks acceptable.
Do you think in a playoff series against the Knicks wouldn't know how to attack Joel Embiid consistently?
I know. You're probably right. Is AD even going to be on the floor?
That's why I said that AD, I think theoretically, as somebody who's healthier than Embiid, and when he does play, does show that he's an elite defender still. And I think with a pick and roll partner Maxey, like he would be completely unlocked. Because this idea that Dallas had coming in the season, like, we're going to give the ball to AD and generate offense. Like, no. AD is a finisher. AD is a pick-and-roll partner. He's one of the best finishers we've ever seen. And Maxey has proven to be an elite pick-and-roll operator. Him and AD. AD with Cade Cunningham. AD with Luka Doncic. I think AD an elite pick-and-roll operator would be incredible still if he could ever be on the floor. I feel like I'm one of the last people on the Anthony Davis ships. I just do think he could be a remarkable player with the right complementary talent.
One last thing on the Sixers, Paul George, that $50-plus million salary with him. Paul George has been really good defensively this year. Just want to point that out. He's been really good defensively. Sure. He's hitting his spot-up three-pointers. He's playing within his role offensively.
Is he a neutral contract?
I mean, he's overpaid. He's still overpaid.
I don't even want to get into plus value and all of that crap because I hate that kind of – like, is he doing – what is expected of him given the amount of money that he's paid?
Well, no.
No.
He's not for what he's getting paid. Not for what he's not. He's a $20 million guy pretty much right now. Paid $55 million.
Yes.
And that's obviously, like, if you could flip him, you do it. But he's been good. Just want to point that out. The last team I want to talk about with you was the Warriors, because over the weekend, Draymond Green got ejected again. Second time in a couple of weeks that happened. He also self-ejected himself from a game after his argument with Steve Kerr. And, you know, the Warriors, they're a circus right now, Waz, because on one hand, you have this Draymond show where for only the second time in his Warriors tenure, the Warriors have a better defense when he's off the floor than when he's on the floor. They've been really good with Quentin Post defensively. And then on the other side of things, the Stephen Curry show is still amazing to watch. He's averaging 28.8 points per game. That's the fourth most in his career, on 64.2% true shooting. That's the fifth best of his career. So Steph, at age 37, is having one of still the incredible. Best, most efficient, high-volume scoring seasons he's ever had. The Warriors are this average team in the play-in again, and yet there's these two sides of this circus with Golden State right now. What do you think they should be doing as the trade deadline approaches here, Waz? Are they a team that should be trying to be aggressive to build around Steph?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's earned that right. By far the greatest player in the history of your franchise. I would say he's the greatest athlete in the history of the Bay Area. I'm talking about Jerry Rice, Joe Montana. Probably not better than Barry Bonds. But whatever. He's right there in terms of the area.
I don't know. And his stature. Bonds didn't win four championships.
That's fair.
Like
That's
Stephen fair. Curry.
Bonds is probably the best baseball player ever. We probably can't say that about Stephen Curry.
That's fair.
You know. But we love them both. That being said, I'm a Steph apologist. I'm a Steph. Why the hell are we going putting all the chips in for Steph? Mortgaging the future for Steph. Like, look at the level that he's still playing at. Why shouldn't you be trying to maximize the remaining areas of the Steph years? Also, you know what I loved? Absolutely loved. The reports come out that the Warriors are interested in Anthony Davis, But Draymond's not on the – no, Draymond's not on the – he's not – he wouldn't be a part of the
Draymond deal, like, would guys. Have to be on the table. To be He'd have to be. Financially, like, he would have Draymond to be in there with Kuminga. Like, it's just impossible.
100% in that deal.
You have to get – the only question with that was would be, would Steph approve of trading Draymond, or would the Warriors front office do it behind his back? I think
Steph would
the
be
Warriors,
making a mistake if he didn't give the go-ahead to that.
I agree with you. Totally agree. AD is an upgrade. You have a chance to get ring five.
A major upgrade.
You have
He's a major
to,
upgrade.
Yes.
He's a major that, that's upgrade. And it's just the way Draymond is comporting himself this season is it's just this seem like this seems like the end of the road. This just seems like the last blow up before the divorce. You ever watch Marriage Story? This seems like that. Oh, you should watch it. It's not a movie that you want to watch more than once. It's a movie about divorce. It's sad, depressing. Like my girlfriend was watching. My girlfriend, excuse
you watch
me.
Lifetime.
What movie?
Lifetime movie. It sounds like a Lifetime movie.
No, man, it's Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver. Oh, wow. What are you talking about? It's a Netflix movie. Anyway, it's about divorce.
Yeah, it's
a Netflix movie.
Popping in my head. Okay.
It's really sad. Like, I watched it. I thought it was excellent. I never want to go back to it. Just like my girl was watching Killers of the Flower Moon, where there's like white guys are stealing Native people's land. I'm like, I don't want to watch this again. It's like, this is freaking sad. Like, this is like, that's what it feels like watching Draymond. It's like the end of a sad divorce. Like, it's over. Like, this is just, it's time to move on from one another. And so, yeah, I think they would be smart to move on from Draymond. And I'm a Draymond Green guy. Like, I'm the guy on my podcast telling these dudes that Draymond Green is the defender of a generation. Like, Draymond Green is integral to everything the Golden State Warriors have achieved in this run. Like, Draymond Green is going to be deserving of a statue, his number retired, all of that stuff. With Golden State. That being said, it's a wrap. Change of scenery is needed. He's yelling at Steve Kerr to the point where he can't control himself from stopping and like storms off the court. Like, it's over, KOC.
I mean, that's the off-court stuff, but even on court, defensively, he can't do it night in, night out in the way he did before. There's so many times in which he's getting ejected or self-ejecting himself from games, and then Quentin Post goes in there, and, you know, Santos is playing, and Kerr's playing with the bigger lineups, and suddenly, oh, wait, we're performing way better defensively at this point. And I think with Kerr, that's what, like, just baffled me was. About what he said. He was on the Tom Tolbert show last week, and he said, you know, we want to be in the final eight, gives ourselves a chance. But he said, I don't want fans to be disillusioned into thinking that we're going to be competing for titles year in, year out the next few years with the Spurs and the Thunder. And this gets back to our conversation earlier about how there's no certainties with the Thunder. There's no certainties with the Spurs. So Kerr knows that. Kerr was a player. Kerr is a committed coach. He knows the difficulties in going back to back. He knows the difficulties in being a young team and taking the leap. And then he goes on to talk about, you know, teams that have given up picks to go for it, the Clippers and the Suns and the Bucks. And he's like, you can't paint yourself into a corner by being risky and irresponsible. I just think the most irresponsible thing the Warriors could do is by not making the choice to maximize the chances for Stephen Curry, still an all-NBA talent, still one of the 5 to 10 best players of basketball, and not giving that guy the opportunity, the best opportunity he can get, to go win an NBA Finals again. There's still a chance when you have a player of this caliber, if you make one or two really good moves to bolster your team. And whether one of those is AD or it's Trey Murphy or it's Michael Porter Jr. or whoever it is, the Warriors are in the conversation to win the finals if they make some changes. And so to say, oh, we're going to keep all these picks. We're going to hoard all these picks for down the line. I think it's absurd. I can't believe Kerr has taken this perspective. It's nuts to me, Waz.
It seems it's weird because management will go out of their way to diss him subliminally. Like where Laker, you know, replies to an email that he knows is going to be leaked and says that, well, you know, the coaches sometimes don't like playing players. Like, so management will throw you under the bus, but you're going to toe the company line. You know what I mean? Like, on a regular basis, I think that Steve being too diplomatic for his own good and also just being a little bit too honest in the sense that our two best players are Steph and Jimmy Butler, both under contract for one more year after this one, and both are 37, 36, like they're older. You can't expect them to be competing as consistently as Shai Gilgeous or Wembanyama does. Like these guys are early to mid-20s. These guys are late 30s. Like they speak into that reality. That being said, that doesn't mean that management shouldn't be trying to maximize what they can do this season. And this idea that like, no, because Steph's not going to be here one day and we're going to be hamstrung. That Steph Curry, like, your franchise valuation, Joe Lacob, since you bought this fucking thing, you went from getting booed on Chris Mullin night to your franchise being one of the most valuable entities in American sports, but for one fucking man. What are you talking about? You don't want to mortgage the future. Your future is paid for by Stephen Curry. The future value that you and all your Spalpine Kendall Roy kids are going to get to enjoy for the rest of their lives was spiked by who? Stephen Curry did that for y'all. He don't get to enjoy none of that equity in the team when he leaves. When your franchise is worth $12 billion in 20 years from now, he don't get to enjoy none of that equity. So this idea that you're mortgaging the future, fuck out of here. Steph Curry gave you that future, mother. Put a team around.
Thank you, Oz. Thank you, Oz. Exactly. Maximize, and like they'll probably say like Kerr wants Warriors fans to believe, oh hey, you know, like we traded for Butler last year, we made a move. That was a buy low from a disgruntled player.
Oh my God, they didn't.
Nobody
do
else really wanted.
They agreed to extend him for 2 years.
Yes,
and actually, Kev, they didn't even extend him for 2 years. They added 1 year and $10 million extra to the deal that he already had. So he had an option for 53. They ripped up that 53 option, turned it into a 2 year 120. So, like, you know, $7 million to what he already was going to be owed and tacked on an extra year. Yeah, I ain't do nothing crazy for Jimmy Butler. And Jimmy Butler's been pretty damn good, if I do say so myself.
He's been good. I mean, Butler has added what the Warriors needed with variety on offense. He gets in the paint. Mm-hmm. He lives at the free throw line. He keeps the team afloat when Steph is off the floor. He's giving the team what they needed. Draymond Green is not. And some of these role players are not. But a lot of the role players are solid. Like, I think it's not like this team is Steph and Butler and nobody else. Like, Quinn Post has been really good. Spencer's been really good. Like Podzimski has figured things out playing more of an off-ball role recently. They have some good Trace Jackson Davis in the game. Draymond gets thrown out. He's been pretty good bringing energy as a five. And so I think this Warriors team, man, like it's open. You got to go for it. Take the opportunity. Go out and get somebody. Invest some of those picks. And they have the rights to all of their picks, Waz, except for their 2030 pick, which is reverse protected. It goes to the Wizards if it lands 21-30, but they have the top 20 rights to that pick, so they have the highest value side of that 2030 pick. Essentially, they have all their future assets besides the 21-30 slot in 2030. So they can trade up to 4 first, 3 swaps. Kuminga, go out and do something. Like if they don't do anything, I think it is talk about
it's
like
a travesty.
It would be a travesty. It would be a slap in the face to Steph, a slap in the face to Warriors fans. That's exactly what would be irresponsible, is doing something like that. So you and I are on the same page with the Warriors, Waz. Hopefully we see them make a move in the weeks to come. Man, how's the new show going, man? How are you doing, Waz?
It's going good, man. Like Danny and Paul are just great guys, man. They love the NBA, obviously just as much as we do, and obviously they have a just unique perspective. Paul being a Hall of Famer, top 75, you know, all American in college and high school, like played with one of the greatest franchises in the league. Like he has such an incredible pedigree and background. And so he comes with such a great perspective. And Danny, you know, he was a role player, but he's one of the great role players of our time, as evidenced by him being a starter on three different NBA Finals championship winning teams, right? And these guys just have incredible perspectives, given their background, and they just have a great enthusiasm for the game and are willing to be pretty candid, which I find like that'd be the hardest thing with player driven stuff. Some guys just don't want to be critical of guys in the league because they feel like they're part of the fraternity. And no, Paul and Danny, yeah, they're going to speak their mind, which I appreciate. So if you want to hear some guys, some players speaking their minds about the game today and not like sort of couching it and being nice and all of that, I think we do a good job of doing that at the show while also being fair. They let me fly off the handle.
Yeah, you're the crazy one.
Exactly.
Was. Thank you so much for joining, man. Always good to pod with you, man. Have a great rest of your day.
Anytime, brother. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Waz. Coming up, we have David Lee with Draft Class and Hawks Talk. And a quick reminder, if you have not hit that subscribe button on YouTube at Yahoo NBA, please do so now. Here's David. All right, it's time for Draft Class. Joining me today from the Fifth Factor, David Lee. David, how are you?
And I'm good. Thank you for reaching out. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
I appreciate you coming on. You just launched your website. It's a NBA draft website. It's a podcast as well. You track rookies, young players in the NBA, NBA draft prospects. But I want to start off with you because you're Atlanta-based. You also cover the Hawks. The state of the Atlanta Hawks, this season they are 17-20, 15-12, plus 1.1 net rating without Trae Young, 2-8, minus 6 net rating with Trae Young on the floor. I want to start off there because I think Atlanta is interesting, not just because they could have the number one pick in the draft. Of course, they have the Pelicans pick from their draft night trade last year. But some of the players on this team, I think, are interesting through a draft lens this year. And I want to start off, of course, with Trae Young because he's out right now. The whole discussion around the NBA right now is, will they trade him? Who would want to trade him for him right now? What are your thoughts overall, David, right now about the state of Trae in Atlanta?
I was nervous coming into the season with the amount of attention that the Hawks got, right? And a lot of times that comes with, you know, expectations. And there was, a bit of a overreaction to some of the moves they had made in terms of how really well fleshed out this team was and how built they're going to be able to succeed if KP goes down or inevitably when KP would go down. And more than anything, I think that KP's absences and sort of inconsistencies in the lineup is the biggest reason why the Hawks have seen this underwhelming season, more than anything. And I think the timing of Trae's injury was unfortunate as well because they really needed that sample size as they go into the trade deadline to understand whether this particular core is going to work with him as well. And as someone who like goes through every game and tracks the play-by-play, the play calls, stuff like that, they play the same way in terms of the same sets, but they run a lot more pick and roll. And with the way that Trae's coming back from the MCL injury, he was playing through Achilles soreness last year, that burst hasn't exactly been there. And I think that's a big reason why you've seen like his own individual efficiency or efficacy as a scorer hasn't been the level that you would want from him. But I really don't feel like there's enough of a sample size to say, hey, whether or not they should move on from Trae. I still think that this team is still very reliant on his creation. But when you see the ascension of Nikhil and you see the ascension of Jalen Johnson and Dyson Daniels, plus the New Orleans Pelicans pick, it absolutely opens up more avenues for them to improve this team and build this roster. I still think this is a poor defensive roster with or without Trae. They've got guys they got to cover for with or without Trae on the floor. But of course, the more people you have to cover for, the tougher it gets. And this, as of right now, this is not a good defensive roster, whether he's on the floor or not.
Would you trade for AD or trade Trae specifically for AD?
I don't think there's any way I would do that just because KP's expiring and I'd rather have that flexibility from that. And I really think you're kind of just swapping. I don't want to call AD or KP a problem necessarily, but more so like the availability concerns. This isn't a roster that I think should be trying to add long-term salary in that sort of that type of player. Like I think it'd have to be someone who's a little bit closer to the other guys on the roster's timelines. But of course, you can't be too picky. So, I mean, if it's the right deal, but there's just absolutely no way I would put in the Pelicans pick or even the Cavs pick with the way that's looking as well.
I mean, it's kind of, I mean, that Chris Mannix over at Sports Illustrated, you mentioned how you wouldn't give up the Pelicans pick. He reported how the Mavericks are trying to do everything they can to pry away that pick from the Hawks. And the phrasing he used, pry away, makes me feel, and this connects with, you know, the conversations I've had with execs around the league, is that these are indeed real discussions that are happening between these two franchises, and that there are negotiations here. Now, it would be foolish for the Hawks to give up what could be the number one pick in the draft for old Anthony Davis. It would be ridiculous if they were to do something like that. But I do think there's something there with this Hawks roster where I do see the appeal. If you can flip Trae Young to get Anthony Davis, I see appeal there with adding a guy who can be an enforcer on this defense. But I'm not giving up that pick. I'm not giving up a lot of long-term value. That said, though, David, I am curious, would you be willing to swap picks in that case? In other words, like, would you give up the rights to the Pelicans pick if you can swap it for the Mavericks pick, which could also be in the lottery? In theory, both those picks could be in the top four. Would you do something like that to get 80?
I don't think so, just because of where I view, or my opinion on this Pelicans roster. Like, coming into the season, of course, I have ulterior motives as someone who covers the Hawks, that I wanted that pick, you know, to not do well. But that particular roster just is not super conducive to winning at this point. You know, like, they've got a ton of issues in the front court. They're playing a lot of young guys, and I feel a little bit more comfortable projecting that one. I remember around the time that the trade was picked, there were multiple GMs or quotes that were going around that most teams had that projected in the lottery or top five even before that draft and that trade happened. So I would definitely want to hang on to that pick at all costs. Like, this very, I can really, like, really just be honest, or to be honest, I mean, if Anthony Edwards, a guy like that, I think my bigger problem, or the type of package I would put together if I had to do an AD trade, would be centered around KP. You get that expiring money. I think that's probably a little bit more appealing to Dallas, because I'm assuming that Kyrie will probably be back February, March, maybe sometime around then. And so then you can sort of say, hey, you got this expiring salary. You can see if he works with Flag. You can see if he works with Kyrie. Maybe you throw in Luke Kennard. Reza Shea is another piece that I think still has intrigue. And I think he has value as a guy who's a replacement level wing. Now, that's not a guy you want at number one, but he does have some malleability in his lineups. And he's had a positive influence on the Hawks. But I do want to caution people who look at, like, Reza Shea's impact, whether it's on-off numbers or anything like that, because he doesn't close games. And so it's not that he doesn't play high leverage minutes, but he's not on the floor to really close out these games. So you'll see that his on-off ratings are, like, really favorable. But, you know, there's some caveats to that. There's some context to that.
Now, with Trey, Hawks fans and I have gone each other quite a lot over the years, because I've always been quite critical of Trey Young. Have you soured on Trey at all this season in recent years?
I think that's an interesting question, because, you know, I want to separate as much as I can my own individual fandom from my analysis, right? Like, that's something I really aim for and strive for. But of course, as an Atlanta native, and Trey is really important to this city, and he's been important to my fandom individually, I've always had a favorable view of him. I think that if I was seeing this Hawks team as a legitimate defense first roster that looked dramatically different with or without him, I would probably say, hey, it may be time. But where I think I sort of hesitate, despite the fact that, of course, he gets mismatch hunted to oblivion against certain teams, I think that the infrastructure problems go far beyond Trey, right? And so if, whether it's the, you know, the backup center thing, size on the wing, the fact that Reza Shea hasn't quite filled out his frame, they haven't found that guy where they can say, hey, we don't want to have Dyson. We want Dyson roaming. We don't want Dyson to have to check every, like, number one option. I think that Trey at his peak in 2022 was absolutely worth the defensive trade-offs. I think right now, if he's going to, with this level of burst, with the level of sort of lack of athleticism we've seen from him creating without a screen, it becomes a lot tougher. Like that one, there was a play against New York, end of the game, he comes off an away screen with a curl action, and he curls into Mitchell Robinson. And because he doesn't either trust his knee or his burst, he doesn't attack him, he doesn't pull it back out, he throws it back to James Johnson, it's a turnover. And I've seen V. Krejci take that and drive it. I've seen Luke Kennard take that and drive it. I've seen Nikhil. And so when you can't give the ball to the best player and attack off ball because of his limitations of size or whether it's the burst, that's where it becomes, okay, maybe the offensive impact isn't worth the defensive trade-offs. Again, I feel like I need to see more this season, and I want to give him grace, but they only have so much time for the trade deadline. And there are other pieces that are sort of pushing the issue, whether it's like Nikhil's, that he's scaled up amazingly. He's such an awesome offensive player.
I mean, I think with when it comes to small guards, David, right? Like, I think Trey, obviously, he had some great heights offensively. And some of the clips that played on the screen earlier, we saw Jalen Brunson against the Hawks, and Jalen Brunson, right, another small guard. Small guards can offer value in the NBA, but even the Knicks right now, among Knicks fans, the discussion is, well, are we going to be able to be good enough defensively with Brunson and Cat, specifically with the Brunson lineups out there, with the way he can be attacked? How much does the challenges of success for a small guard impact your evaluation of small guards in the draft, like a Darius Acuff from Arkansas?
No, I mean it's so relevant. I think Sam Vecenie had an interesting tweet that I came across where he was like, "It's so much easier, or NBA teams are so much better at attacking mismatches than they are at the collegiate level." And Acuff, at this point, has been so productive, he's been such a great shot maker that, if he continues this throughout the season, I can't really knock him too much. But as of right now, I'm definitely lower than consensus. Somewhat for the reason that you mentioned about some of the difficulties of building around a smaller guard. But he also just doesn't give you much outside of the scoring and the playmaking. And I don't necessarily rate the playmaking high enough to excuse that. One of my favorite guys on Twitter, DBC Jason, he does some draft stuff and then as well some fantasy stuff. He put together a graphic of like guys with a steal percentage below 1.5. And it's not an inspiring list, and we know that steal percentage is a good proxy for feel, but also like defensive viability, especially for guards. Like, I think Acuff's frame is really great for his size. I think, I can't remember his wingspan off the top of my head, but I want to say it's maybe +2, +3. So, you know, I don't think his hands are that level though, like maybe like a Reed Shepard or a guy like that. And some of these guys on this list, like Bub Carrington, Jordan Hawkins, Cam Thomas, John Jenkins. And again, not the most inspiring company. It's not the only sort of evaluator or statistic I'll look at, but it's something to consider because someone like Acuff has to be disruptive to be viable defensively. And again, the frame will help him a little bit. Maybe his touch will continue to be this amazing from the floater range, but there are so many other guards that I prefer as opposed to like really disliking Acuff. And I know that the Arkansas faithful are like out in droves about defending him. And look, he's playing great. I understand, but I think I just want to see how it looks in conference play.
Yeah, 29 against Tennessee.
Yeah. He looked great.
Yeah, he looked great. But I think, you know, there's also the people who are just going to say, well, you take a Calipari guard and these guys tend to pan out in the NBA. There's going to be people who just simply say that and never mind the Arkansas fans, as you said. But I think with him, like, you raise good points. Is he offering enough aside from the scoring? I mean, this year, just to give some context, 19.5 points per game, 6 assists per game, shooting 44% from threes, 3-level score. He's got a floater shooting over 50% on floaters. He's got the mid-range. He can pull up off the dribble. He can hit circus shots at the rim. He's a very talented scorer. But to your point, he's listed at 6'3". We'll see how he actually measures come NBA draft combine time. But I think part of it is that there's just – the traditional point guard, like these 6'1", 6'2", 6'3 guys, is dead at this point. I mean, you can be an initiator at 6'8 or 6'10. And with the Hawks, I think you see a guy like Jalen Johnson as an initiator at 6'9 with his size. It lessens the need to have to bet on a quote smaller guard to have to handle that creation responsibility. And with Jalen Johnson specifically, I want to pivot into him here because, David, like year to year, like he barely plays in college, year to year in the NBA, it's been one leap after another with him. What is the difference this year with Jalen Johnson compared to any other year prior that you've observed?
Yeah, it's a great question. And he was kind of like an unknown commodity, which I think is so fascinating. Even when he got to the Hawks, Lloyd Pierce wasn't playing him much. Nate McMillan wasn't playing him much. He was kind of like relegated to the corner. But what we've seen from him, I think, is the growth as a driver and a half-court operator. He had a masterful game against Charlotte. They ended up losing that game. That was earlier in December. But, I mean, in all facets, you know, as attacking out of the roller. Well, that was the first game when Trey came back. So he was like attacking as a short roller. He was attacking in transition. Some of the bump fade stuff that he's been able to get to, creativity around the rim, where I think he, honestly, with how amazing he's been, there's still a lot of growth though. Like the Hawks go to clutch sort of play that they'll go to is an inverted pick and roll. Usually they have Nikhil Alexander Walker set the screen. And Jalen, because he doesn't have much of a threat as like a pull-up three-point shooter, or even as a, he's more comfortable for whatever reason, driving and pulling up from like the baseline as opposed to the middle of the floor. So that could be a little bit nasty. That is one of their least efficient actions. Like on the seat that I track, I've got them at 30 possessions with that. And they're like 0.6 points per possession, which for reference, 0.96 is the average half court possession. So he still has areas of refinement, and that's the scary part, because he's walking into triple doubles, you know, with ease. I think the next challenge for Jalen is figuring out where that optimal usage is for his defense to not completely fall off. Because again, like Trey, very frustrating. I can imagine playing as a team when you have to cover for him. But Jalen Johnson is 6'10" and he's 250 pounds. So it's when he has these defensive lapses and when he's not rotating, when he's not scramming guys out of switches, that would frustrate me more than Trey, to be honest, if I was defending alongside Jalen Johnson. So again, with the way that his offense has scaled up, I completely understand why we've seen a drop off in the defensive efficacy. And he also did not get time in Atlanta as a role player, if that makes sense. Like maybe in that first like 2024 season, he wasn't super involved offensively, but he didn't really get the time to say, hey, just go out there and play defense. Just go out there and pass. Just go, you know, do these little things. And so I think that that part has kind of diminished a bit from his game. And it's not a motor thing. I think it's more so like his role is to get the rebound and go on offense. And the sort of like the mental usage that it takes to run an offense is taking a toll on his defensive awareness. And that's kind of been a problem throughout his career. So that's the biggest thing. If he can figure out the clutch offense, if he can be more polished in the half court, and if he can figure out how to get a little bit more defensive efficacy, I think we're really looking at like a top 15 guy. And I don't think that's hyperbole to say that. I'm curious to see how you feel about that as well.
No, I don't think it is at all. I mean, I think for him, like offensively, the dude is just so versatile with his ability to generate positive actions for the Hawks. Like you mentioned, the rebounding as well, the playmaking. With him, it's like, yes, if he can just figure out defense while also handling this offensive load. He's only 24 years old. And I think he just turned 24 as well in December. So it's not like he's near 25 at this point. He's not yet in his prime, in theory. I mean, in 2-3 years, it's very possible the Jalen Johnson we're talking about is, as you said, a potential all-NBA guy that is on the table for the Hawks, which is why I think they're one of the more fascinating teams in the league, because there's a lot of good things cooking with the team. Yeah. I mean, like, I think Jalen Johnson being the most appealing, Okongwu continuing to add layers to his game, adding a three-pointer as well. Dyson Daniels, of course, coming off the year that he had, adding Nikhil Alexander-Walker. There's a lot of good stuff here. I still really like Asa Newell as well. We'll see what he turns into in the years to come. But, and of course, they have this pick at the top of the draft, courtesy of the New Orleans Pelicans. Now, Zachary Risache, their former number one pick, you know, you go to your website and you click over, I'm playing around with it. I see the rookie sophomore tracker on the Fifth Factor. And, you know, who do I see this morning on the trending down section? It's Zachary Risache. Risache in the trending down section on Fifth Factor. And that's because he's not had a great season, has not had a great stretch as of late. With Risache, what's your level of concern with him being something much more than, as you said earlier, a replacement level wing?
It's tough for Risa to say. At the time when we went into that draft class, my board was Sar for the Hawks in particular. I wanted Sar number one, and I think Ron Holland or Modis were 2A, 2B, then Klingon. And then I was like, I would not like this, but I could understand the process, and that would be Risa Shea. And a big reason why I was not the biggest fan of Risa going into that draft cycle was a lot of times we'll see this with international guys. Sometimes they will get hot at the end of the season, and then they're sort of like the recency bias. I don't think that necessarily informed the Hawks decision, but I think the overall discourse around Risa got more favorable around that time. And he, to his credit, was performing and producing in a professional context. And he's doing some of those same things, but I think the deficiencies have been very loud. Like in his time at J.O. Borg, extremely high pick and roll turnover percentage. And the half court efficacy was always a question. And I think sometimes he plays smaller than he should be, especially when he contests shots. He tends to leap forward instead of jumping up. So he kind of makes himself smaller. He already doesn't have a great wingspan relative to his size. I think what Risa does really well that fits well with this Hawks team is he gets out and runs in transition, like one of the better or one of the highest transition frequency differential players in the league. I think maybe around like 8 or 9%. And he helps the Hawks a lot in that way because he'll leak out. And of course, Jalen Johnson and Trae Young are really effective at finding him. And I think the problem, and this is again why you may have to consider seeing how Trae fits into the fold, is that Risa is the most dependent on Trae Young. Any starter, pretty much any player in the starting lineup or in the entire lineup in general. And the Hawks have to figure out, okay, how can we continue to get this version of Dyson that's more aggressive, that's getting downhill, that's producing as a passer with Trae off the floor? How can we continue to lean into Jalen Johnson as a playmaker? And then how can we figure out how to best utilize Zach? Because they start off most games with an away curl pin down action for him. And if that shot isn't immediately there, then they have to move on to the second action because he can't necessarily create something from nothing at this point. And I don't think he feels comfortable. I don't think he has the handle. I don't think he has the strength. There's still moments where you're like, okay, this is a very clear guy that could fit into this core long term. And I don't think that this on his rookie contract, like I would include in him like an AD trade or something like that. But there's a reason why he's not closing games. And it's not that Quinn Snyder doesn't like him. It's not that he's not being developed. It's that Nikhil and Veet are better players than him at this point. Depending on the matchup, they may need that size, but I'm never really upset with Quinn saying, hey, let's close with Nikhil. Let's close with Veet.
I mean, they absolutely are better players right now. And I think with Risa, I mean, I was not high on him at all prior to the draft. I think I had him 10th or 11th on my board, and then he goes number one. And it's like, well, you know, maybe this will go down as a big whiff, or it'll go down as the correct decision. And like, we're only a year and a half in. I mean, there's still a long runway of him to figure things out. But my concerns pre-draft were him where, you know, you mentioned the shot creation. This year, he ranks in the 21st percentile in points per drive. He's shooting only 54% on unassisted half-court shots at the rim. It's that, but also the shooting. I mean, he was very inconsistent, very streaky overseas before coming to the NBA. Right. It's been very much the same thing through 109 games so far with the Hawks, 34.8% from three, 69.7% from the line through his year and a half so far in the NBA. That's 36% on catch and shoot threes, 25% on dribble jumper threes, only 38% from mid-range. And I think there's no doubt that he has the ability to be a really, really good defensive player. But if he's not going to be a knockdown shooter, if he's not going to be a creator, and to your point, David, if he's not going to be able to a little bit, you know, in terms of creating, finishing at the basket, getting stronger, well, that really, it's going to limit your ability to be on the floor in end game situations. And that's why when it comes to including him in an Anthony Davis trade, obviously, as the number one pick, obviously, in just the second year of his career, you'd rather take him out of that and continue to bet on him. It's not a great return on value. But it's also possible that the value isn't going up from here, and that this is a way to get something of value back that helps you now rather than seeing this asset diminish further. And I think there is some logic to doing that from Atlanta's perspective if they were to put him into an Anthony Davis trade.
Yes, yeah, it's unfortunate because I think that a lot of guys are going to their viewpoint or their perception will always be diluted by where they're picked in the draft. You know, like that. If I almost wish the Hawks would have just taken Trey and not traded him for Luka, because those two guys, their legacies were, you know, inevitably going to be intertwined for the rest of their careers. Now, of course, you know, they got Cam Reddish out of that, you know, all of that. But I think that Risa, if he goes 10th, if the Hawks stay at 10th, where their odds were, they take Risa. Do we have this same negative perception of him? I think absolutely not. Right?
No, like chance. I agree.
He's entirely perfect. He's entirely fine. Mm-hmm. And that's, but unfortunately, and again, that class was nebulous and sort of billed as one of the worst classes ever, which I don't, you know, a year and a half removed, I don't really think it stacks up to that. But I mean, you mentioned the defensive stuff. What's concerning, again, and this was evident in the pre-NCAA stuff, or the pre-NBA stuff, he doesn't generate deflections. He's not drawing offensive fouls. He's like 50, he's like league average in deflections. His rim field goal percent or differential +4.5%, the 17th percentile. And then he's one of the more deficient high volume spaces in the league because his shot isn't falling. He's at a -11 spacing relative to shooting percentage. And watching a lot of Zach, his footwork can be inconsistent. You mentioned some of the sporadic sort of like streaks of where he's, you know, shooting well, he's shooting not, or shooting not well. And some, I think a lot of that has to do with his base, his feet. When he comes off movement three, sometimes his feet kick out, sometimes they don't. He doesn't have like a consistency in his role. He doesn't have a consistency in his shooting form. He doesn't have a consistency in what he's asked to do or what he does on the court. So I think that, you know, we saw a bit of frustration from him, and I don't think that was due to Quinn Snyder or anything like that. I think that he thought he was supposed to go in. He wasn't, I don't know what exactly happened, but I almost feel like you kind of needed to see him show a little bit of fire because that he kind of was drafted as a guy that's like, hey, you're going to play a role. But like, if he believes he can do more than that and he wants to voice that, okay, prove it to us. But I like to see that from him in particular, because I haven't really seen him advocate for himself in general. He's kind of always had like this, I'm just happy to be here, or I'm not an NBA athlete, you know? So it's good to see that from him.
Well, let's move on to the potential number one pick in this year's draft. Darren Peterson, he returned to Kansas over the weekend. He had 26 points in 23 minutes, still on a minutes restriction right now, but he's 5-for-10 from three in his return, finished a lob dunk. Looks super, super smooth. He had a play where it was one of my favorite buckets that he scored, where he caught the ball, I think, in the middle of a zone around the free throw line. Just the quickness with his ability just to zigzag right to the rim. He's just so shifty with his movements. Everything looks so natural with him. But at this point, David, he's only played 5 games. It's just 5 games still right now, still on a minutes restriction. Where are you at with Darren Peterson? Where is he on your board? And what would you like to see from him this month as he makes his return back to the court, hopefully?
Yeah, I have DP second. I still have Cam Boozer ahead of him. I'm curious how you feel about this, KOC, because I do think, yes, Darren Peterson, he looked great first game back, but I also do think there's a bit of anchoring bias with like some of the takes that I'm seeing as a result of that game, because it was not the most, I guess the most enticing sort of performance from, because I've seen DP
spot up threes, right?
Exactly.
Okay. A bunch of threes.
Yeah. Like this was an Aaron Nesmith game for me. Like I was like, okay, I've seen Aaron Nesmith.
That's a great way to
spot
it.
Up, you know, get alley oop, and which is fine. I think the defensive playmaking, he had a notable block at the rim. Mm-hmm. I don't think his calf is fully healthy. I don't know what's going on, but like the burst from high school tape wasn't there. Some of the rim pressure, even from the statistical indicators, isn't there. The fact he's still able to rise up and knock down these shots, very impressive. But I don't particularly think that, yes, the shots went in. Yes, it's good that he's getting threes up. Yes, he got them in a variety of different spot-up scenarios. But this was not the type of game that would say, hey, oh, he's back on number one for me. You know, I'm not there.
Yeah, I'm not there right now either. I mean, you got to see him play basketball games. He's sitting on a chair in the second half of that game. I mean, it's just I need to see him play more often, especially given what Cam Boozer is doing, especially what AJ DiBonta is doing. I am curious. You mentioned you have Boozer number one on your board. A lot of people seem to have him number three at this point. A lot of people you talk to, it's either Peterson or DiBonta one for them. What is the argument in your eyes for Cam Boozer as the first pick in the draft?
No, for sure. So, I mean, on my site, I use a metric called daily RAPM estimate, which is a daily sort of approximation of how good a game that a player has. And Boozer is number one in the players on my board right now. He's the most productive player in the country. Of course, that's the points. But his game is just really resilient. And, you know, with all the concerns about some of his verticality or the burst, whatever it may be, he's been incredibly productive. And I tend to trust production more than anything. And also, I really, really buy his overall playmaking and feel. So he's at a 2-assisted turnover. He's at a 3.3 steal percentage. There's definitely concerns about like the overall rim influence. Like I think his numbers with and without Pat Ngongwa, the Duke's offense, or Duke's defense isn't nearly as suppressive at the rim. Like they go from like a 26th rim defensive field goal percentage, like 50% to like 61 with Boozer on and Ngongwa off. So that is definitely a concern. But I think I'm also just really enthralled with like how many different ways he can attack offensively. I do think that Duke's particular roster this year is not super conducive to his most optimal way to use him. Like the guard, I'll think a lot about like, okay, how good would he be if it was Colin Knipl and Tyrese Proctor and Sion James and, you know, guys like this, like who could, you know, somewhat manufacture these looks a little bit better. And I'm really sort of encouraged by the way that Duke is using him at the top of the key, playmaking as a hub and some of the interactions that he's had with Ngongwa. So I think the combination of the feel, the size, the free throw touch, I'm pretty convinced he's going to shoot it, the way he cleans the glass. He's hitting all the ancillary stuff. He's hitting all the production stuff. So that's why he's been at number one for me. I think if AJ continues this into conference play and if DP gets back on the court, you know, they can end that conversation for me. But I've had Cam number one since June and it hasn't really been challenged for me.
I mean, I had Jonathan Givony on the podcast last week, and he's like, people say, you know, he doesn't shock them, doesn't make them go wow, that he hasn't added stuff to his game. He's like, what are you talking about? He's added stuff to his game every single 100%. Level. And this year, we're seeing more of those layers to what he can do offensively. And I think, to your point, David, if he were on last year's Duke's roster with some of their creators, Con Knipple being one of them, as you said, of course, the year he's having in Charlotte this year, it might be even a bigger, better year for Boozer.
Yeah.
I just think I haven't released my draft guide yet. It's not out yet. I think maybe February we'll drop it, but I haven't ranked the players like in a spreadsheet on my end of things yet. I have them in groups and all that because I'm trying not to anchor myself to anything at this point, but it's just hard to look at Boozer and argue against the level of production from him at every single level, while he's also continued to get better at add more to his game. I don't think he's just a guy who is bullying smaller guys at the high school level. Definitely and not. He's just doing that in college. He's added so much more to his game this year.
Yeah, I mean, I could wax on and off about Cam Boozer, man. Like, I really think that
wax.
This is one of the more...
Wax, David.
I really think this is, like, really one of my favorite prospects that I've ever had the, you know, the privilege to even watch. His numbers are excellent. I understand that it isn't the most enticing, but even like he's at a 15% drive frequency at 6'10", 250. Like, that is not normal. And he reminds me in some ways, not in the same deployment, but like, I was really drawn to Colin Murray-Boyles in last draft class. And like, these types of guys who, you know, some may consider them tweeners. I think in today's NBA, as long as you can pass, you can finish at the rim, you can, you have some potential to, you know, step behind the three-point line and knock down shots, and then you're going to finish at the free throw line. I think that Cam Boozer is going to influence the possession battle. He's going to influence six-factor RPM. He's going to be on the glass. He's going to be passing. He's going to be influencing transition. So he hits all these benchmarks for guys that I really, really value. And on top of that, you know, if he has real shooting ability, then I think this is a guy that will pretty easily return the best value in the class, provided that he does hit those benchmarks.
I mean, in a way, he sort of reminds me of the Cooper discussion last year, where it's like, this is a very high floor player with an unknown ceiling. He could be one of the better players in the game, but at a minimum, you feel like you're going to get an all-star caliber player. And it's very rare to have players with that high floor and very high ceiling, whereas I think there is a wider variance with both Darren Peterson and A.J. DiBonsa. They might not be all-stars, but they also could be top three, top four, top five players in the league if they really hit their peak of their peak upsides. I want to move on to some weekly movers, David. First with a guy who may be moving up your board. Who's moved up your board in recent weeks?
I think Kaden Mingo is a guy for sure for me. He's a guy that he does everything that I want from a guard. Penn State's not a good offense at all. And I remember I was watching that Michigan State game in full maybe 3-4 weeks ago. And the broadcast was like, yeah, this is the first time Michigan State has allowed 70 points to an opponent. And again, like, a lot of that is Mingo. He's a great decision maker under pressure. He pushes the pace. He's at a 3-assist a turnover. He played more as a wing in high school. My co-host on the Fifth Factor podcast, Ahmed Jama, he does a lot of grassroots stuff. And he was early on Kaden Mingo. And when I asked him about the three-point rate stuff, because Mingo's at a 30% three-point rate, which for a lead ball handler. He's like 35% of his possessions are in pick and roll. And at the NBA level, you can't only have 30% of your shots come from three. You're just not going to be a viable pick and roll guy. So he's got to develop that. But I think because he played as a wing in high school, he's not yet comfortable pulling up off the dribble. But he's got great size. He's got great hands. He's on the glass. He's pushing in transition. So guy I really like. Dalen Swain is a guy that I've liked last year as well. Outside of maybe like Josh Jefferson or even Boozer, like, he's the best driver, I feel like, that's over 6'5", 6'6". He's at a 1.33 points per possession on drives. His second most frequent play type is out of pick and roll. He's got a 15% dunk rate. So a functional athlete, good processor, great strength, great length as well. I think pretty sure if I remember his measurements correctly. So he's a guy that I'm definitely really interested to keep watching. And I'll definitely be tuning into a lot of Texas games.
Yeah, he had 34 points and an overtime loss last week. Swain did for Texas. Who's somebody that's moving down your board, David?
Down my board? I think Sanak. Honestly, I didn't really rate Sanak much coming into the season. And this was more so less about him, but I wasn't sure if Houston's coach, his name's escaped me. I wasn't sure if he's going to play. The younger guys, with some of the way he was speaking during preseason. But what concerns me about Sanak is, like, I was a fan of Sarr pre-draft, but Sanak reminds me of all the things that I did not like about Alex Sarr, which is, you know, the contact aversion. It's the set screen setting. Like, Sarr slipped every screen in OTE. He was not setting real screens. He didn't seem like he had much interest in that. Sanak's free throw rate is really low. And it doesn't seem that he has that same issue where he doesn't really set hard screens and he looks to float around. But I got to give him credit because he's been way better on the offensive glass. And in high school, I mean, he had 28 and had his time at Link Academy in his senior year. And he already has, I think he's already surpassed that in like his in less minutes in Houston. And he's also finishing at the rim better than he is all his gimmies. I think what really concerns me is the fact that he's got, I think it's like two or three blocks against competition or like top 100, top 220 comp. They were both below the rim. His free throw rate is low. And I've got a database of like collegiate players that feeds my site. Guys who the average sort of like NBA seasons played and estimated wins contributed, which is from dunks and threes, which is basically like how much value are you adding to your team or your career. It's about 12 estimated wins in about five NBA seasons. Players who were 6'8 and had less than a 20% free throw rate while committing more than four fouls per 40, their estimated wins was 0.22 in two seasons played. It's guys like Jordan Bell. So it's like he has these various red flags. You know, he's fouling a lot. He's not getting to the free throw line. He's not setting hard screens. He's not embracing physicality. He floats around on offense. He takes a bunch of assisted pull-up twos. But all that being said, he could just be an awesome shooter at 6'10". And if he's going to be that level of a shooter at 6'10", and he's kind of like Jabari Smith, sans like the really awesome defensive impact, that's a guy that I don't think I would want to take top 25. I probably would take him a little bit closer to the beginning of the second round. And he might even benefit from a second year. And if there is any place that could install grit into him, it would be Kelvin Sampson's Houston, you know, program. Mm-hmm. So that's why like I would almost like to see him take that one additional year, because I think he could grow. You could address these areas even more than he already has.
Man, the Jordan Bell comp. Ooh, that's not a company you want to be in. Former NBA champion Jordan Bell. I will say that he does have a ring from, I believe it was the 2018 Warriors. That was at his rookie season, I think, with Golden State. Back when it felt like he still had a ton of potential as an early second round pick. But I do think your point about Sanak, if he does go back to college, which he probably should. I think he's somebody, and especially in next year's weaker on paper draft class, it's an opportunity for you to move up in the rankings, and you're going to get paid at Houston anyway. So I think it's a good idea, as you said, for him to go back to school, learn under Kelvin Sampson, and possibly increase your stock entering the 2027 NBA draft. This week, what's a game to watch that you have, David, from a scouting standpoint, something that you're very much looking forward to?
Yeah, for me, I'm really looking forward to the Vanderbilt-Alabama game. So Tyler Tanner is a guy that I, quite honestly, just to be candid, was not super aware of coming into this particular season. When I dug into his freshman year, I was like, wow, this guy's really interesting. So he didn't have a single turnover his first 20 games as a freshman, which is fascinating. I mentioned the value of steals and particularly for guards when we talked Acuff. Tyler Tanner on my site, I have percentiles, right? There's 10 players in the 90th percentile or higher in stocks per game, which is steals and blocks. The nine non-Tyler Tanner players have an average height of 6'10". Tyler Tanner is 6 foot, maybe, could be 5'11". He's an awesome athlete. Like, absolutely does not feel like he's 6 foot. And when we talk about steal percentage as a proxy for feel and NBA impact and all these other things, here's like some of the numbers behind it and why I value it, right? Again, the same estimated wins metric, which I use to power my site. The average career estimated wins among point guards with a steal percentage less than 2.5% in their final collegiate year was about 14.4. Again, for reference, average among my database is about 12. Guys who had PGs who had a steal percentage above 2.5, they're at 28.2. And this is like 150 player sample size. So that is enough of an indicator for me to say, hey, I should value steal percentage. Again, not in a vacuum, but like in totality with the entire prospect's profile, whether it's the tape, the stats, whatever it may be. There isn't a single freshman or sophomore who got drafted with a 2-assist-to-turnover ratio or higher and a steal percentage around like 5 besides Marcus Smart. And you have to like really play with the filters to get there. So obviously a more refined offensive prospect than Marcus Smart, but he's that level disruptor, at least at this point in the season. He had a 14-1. He had 14 assists and 1 turnover in their first conference game against South Carolina. He's at the highest pick and roll volume of his career in those last back-to-back games. So they didn't end up... their other guards weren't available against South Carolina. So Tanner had to really scale up on offense. And I think that is something I'm really interested to track in like this Alabama game, because LeBaron Filon is another guy that I really like. Freshman, you know, he was on the offensive glass. He's getting steals. He was like a very complimentary off guard. This year, he's scaled up massively. Like he's had like a 35 usage, 30 assists. There's like a handful of guys who have done that. And he's still super efficient. He's still taking care of the ball. So like these two guys, and Alabama and Vanderbilt are both like super high-paced teams. So this should be a really fun watch. And I think it'd be interesting to sort of compare how both of these guys operate. Filon's a bit more methodical in the half court, but these two guys would be really interesting to watch.
Vanderbilt 14-0 so far this season. The number 6 offensive rating on KenPom, the number 14 defensive rating on KenPom, going against Alabama's number 2 offense so far this season at 11-3 for Bama. I think you're right. It's a great guard battle, and it's always fun to watch these positional prospects go off against each other, and a good test for Tanner to prove himself against the bigger name in Phylon. David, this is a lot of fun, man. I mean, congrats on launching the site, man. What was the motivation behind launching the Fifth Factor?
Man, thank you. And I think you would understand this more than most, honestly, but it's a gargantuan task trying to evaluate draft prospects. I mean, there's so many teams, there's so many players, thousands of prospects, really. And I really just want to make it easier for myself and other people who are interested in the draft to just track guys you're interested in, understand like some of the statistical indicators that maybe I value, that I'm advocated that you would value as well. And so that's where the site's supposed to function. I have a research paper that's also linked on the site. It's on my Substack that kind of like goes through all the predictive power and all the like you know, the hard science, the hard math that I did behind it. And there's a lot of other things that I have planned for it. Like, I'm going to have full player profiles, comparisons, like here are the most similar NBA players, here are the most similar collegiate players. Here's like, I'm going to have a women's college basketball on there. I'm going to have even more stats, like four factor influence, which is like effective field goal percentage, turnovers, all that. So I'm still building it. I'm really excited to get the reception that I've had, and I definitely appreciate anyone that checks it out. I'm the only guy working on it. So if there's an issue, you can just go ahead and email me. I'll try and fix it as soon as possible. But no, it's been a lot of fun.
It sounds like you basically created something that like you wanted in the world, like something you wanted yourself, right? Like, you created 100%. The website that you wanted. That's the way I felt when I created my NBA draft guide in 2014. I was like, I want like just a page with, you know, pretty, you know, good looking like baseball card style pages and pluses and minuses, like something easily consumable. That was sort of my thought process in 2014 when I did my first year of the draft guide. So it's rewarding to do something like that. Do you want to work in media long term, or would you like to work for a team? Like, it seems like a lot of draft heads like are getting plucked by NBA teams in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to both, but definitely the more intriguing thing to me is working for a team. I think being involved in like decision making, especially from a draft perspective, projections, roster construction, that's what fascinates me the most. I think that there's also like a space for top of the stuff that I work on in the media, whether it's, you know, more nuanced stuff, storytelling, data-driven stuff. Like, to your point, like, I want to make things as digestible as possible, and I want to make things, you know, universally available too. Like, I think there's a data issue, like basketball stuff, unfortunately. You know, data costs. The NBA needs to make money off their data, but it's harder for people, you know, like, who are amateurs to really conceptualize and understand things if they don't have the access to it. So once you want to repackage everything, make it digestible, make it informative. And, you know, if a potential opportunity arises out of that, that's more than fine with me. Of course, I'll take it. But I'm very happy to continue to be working in media and, you know, try to connect with people like yourself, others around the NBA. And I mean, the conversation has been fascinating, and I'm hoping that this site is like that next level for that.
David, congrats on the site. You do awesome work, man. Yeah, your passion and intelligence and work ethic are all like very obvious with everything you put out there. So keep up the great work, and thank you for joining the show today, man.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Big thanks again to Waz and David for joining me on today's episode. If you haven't subscribed to the Yahoo NBA on our YouTube channel yet, please do so now. It's at Yahoo NBA. That's where you can find the video versions of my podcast, The Dunker Spot, and The Big Number, as well as some video breakdown videos we got coming as well. That's at Yahoo NBA on YouTube. Thank you. If you do that, it would be much, much appreciated. Thank you to the whole production staff for putting together today's video. We'll be back again later in the week. Tom Havistro, he'll be back on Thursday. Looking forward to that. Have a good day.